Welcome to this report, Out Against Israeli Apartheid, produced for the CKUT News Collective in conjunction with Under the Olive Tree. Over the course of this reportage, we will look at the growing movements of queer people around the world who are uniting against Israeli apartheid. We will hear a variety of voices from Canada to Palestine of LGBT people, Palestinians or otherwise, who are working on the front lines of the global movement of boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israeli apartheid. While queer people around the world have been at the heart of international solidarity movements for decades, there has been a resurgence of explicitly queer solidarity towards Palestine, especially since the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada, or Uprising, in 2000. For example, in 2001, a queer Israeli group called Black Laundry made waves across the Middle East and around the world after they marched in the Tel Aviv Gay Pride Parade that year under the banner No Pride in the Occupation. Now, 8 years after that, this type of queer solidarity is continuing to grow. First, we'll hear from Natalie Curry-Toe, a member of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid in Toronto, and one of the organizers of the anti-apartheid contingent in the 2009 Toronto Pride Parade.
The group formed really out of discussions that happened following Israeli Apartheid Week in 2008. So what happened at Israeli Apartheid Week that year was that people started to have conversations around the way queerness was mobilized, both by the State of Israel, but also the kind of the conditions of queer Palestinians under occupation. So a group of people gathered together to start having those discussions. They organized a contingent to march in the Pride Parade and marched with another contingent at Toronto Pride in 2008. And so we held an event on May 23rd at Buddies and Bad Times Theater in Toronto that was called Coming Out Against Apartheid, 20 Years of Queer Resistance from South Africa to Palestine. And during that event, we really tried to make some of the connections between the ways that the state mobilized certain types of, used certain types of appeals to liberalism, to liberal democracy, and the role and position of queers under states in the context of South African apartheid and Israeli apartheid. We were able to mobilize a massive contingent for Pride in Toronto that happened in June. So we had, in the end, we got about 180 people who came out to the Dyke March, so we were the biggest contingent in the Dyke March, and over 200 people participated with Queers Against Israeli Apartheid in the Pride Parade.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Pride Parade this year and the Queers Against Israeli Apartheid contingent. As I understand, you guys faced a bit of repression in the lead up to the parade. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that repression was dealt with?
Sure. So we, in our initial planning, so after the event in May, we had conversations about maybe participating in the Pride Parade. None of us were particularly that invested in Pride per se at the time, but we felt like it would be important and significant to have a presence, especially an anti-Israeli apartheid presence in the context of Pride, because we've been finding, especially in Toronto, a lot of queer events have been funded by the Israeli government. So, for example, the Inside Out Film Festival had part of it received funding from the Israeli government, and we just wanted to have a kind of visibility around the conditions of apartheid, at Pride. So we started to have conversations about it, and we had a presence last year, but we hadn't officially signed up to march as a contingent on our own, and we hadn't really thought it through. But before we could even have a conversation about whether or not we wanted to submit an application to participate in the parade, our May 23rd event had garnered some some attention from B'nai B'rith, and one of their members, a man by the name of Martin Gladstone, decided, I think he's a lawyer actually, decided to make a complaint with Pride and request that Pride ban us from marching in the parade. And then this information was circulated by B'nai B'rith. So it wasn't a claim coming from B'nai B'rith, but B'nai B'rith was definitely supporting the Martin Gladstone's case against us with Pride. So at this point, we hadn't even sent in an application. Pride, Toronto, didn't really know what to do with it, but felt compelled to respond in some way. And the press, meanwhile, B'nai B'rith's press release that they sent out got some press attention. And so the press published that we had been banned from the Pride parade, which was, you know, news to us, and, you know, because we hadn't even applied yet to participate in the parade. So then there was a lot of chaos around it, and then Pride took a little bit of time and issued a statement stating that everyone who applied to march in the parade would be given access to it unless the messaging of that contingent violated Canadian laws around hate speech. In some ways it was a way of saying, you know, we're not going to ban anybody from the parade, but another way of saying that that anti-Israeli apartheid activism is somehow, like, you know, without actually saying it, but that somehow at risk of violating Canadian hate crimes laws, which is something that, you know, our group in particular has never, like, been accused of, like, with any kind of valid thing other than to use it as a dismissive technique to dismiss, like, our claims based on an assumption around what we're saying, or a lie, you know, making the ridiculous jump from claiming that criticism of a state is anti-Semitic. So that statement was issued, and we decided that we were going to formally put in an application to march in the parade, because what happened as a result of all of this media attention that this issue got was that hundreds of people started writing letters to Pride Toronto condemning them from banning us, even though, like, they hadn't actually banned us, and it was, like, the press getting excited about it. So all of that kind of confusion that stemmed from, like, really an attempted act of repression and repressing the space of having any kind of criticism of the Israeli state participate in Pride, kind of mobilized our contingent, but it also mobilized, like, a lot of people in the queer community and outside of the queer community to pay attention to Pride. And I think it gave a space for Pride to think about its relationship to political groups and, like, what its role should be in that context. So I think it was a pretty powerful message for people within the queer community to feel like Pride could be politicized again, that we could use Pride as, like, a space for pushing for rights, for pushing for freedoms, and for standing up for the things that we believe in.
So you've been doing research looking at queer solidarity with movements in the Middle East over recent years. Can you tell us a little bit about what some of the turning points have been in terms of, you know, looking at this as a solidarity movement?
I think there's been, like, a kind of an increasingly, like, a growing attention that queers have had to the kinds of political context in the Middle East over the last few years. I think it's been growing since about 2000, 2001, but it really reached a peak in 2006 when World Pride was held in Jerusalem. Or at least it peaked maybe in 2005 or 2004 when World Pride decided that it would hold World Pride in Jerusalem, which was initially scheduled for 2005 and then shifted to 2006. So there was actually, like, a call for boycott of World Pride Jerusalem, which theme called Love Without Borders, and was, like, trying to, or claims to have, like, linked the three major religions of the region. So World Pride Jerusalem ended up happening in 2006, and it happened at the same time that Israel waged a war against Lebanon. And I think that the conditions of a state waging war as people from around the world traveled there as tourists to celebrate being out was the biggest contradiction that so many queers could ever possibly imagine happening. Like, how can you celebrate Pride at the same time that people are being killed on a daily basis within the very state that's doing those bombings? So I think that really mobilized a lot of queers in places like in Canada and the U.S., and as well in Lebanon. And so Helem, which is a gay and lesbian kind of organization, like advocacy organization in Beirut, converted their center, their office, into a relief center. And then there was a call out for international support for their efforts, and groups in Montreal organized a fundraising event, and there was like support from groups around, like all over the place, for the work they were doing. And I think that that was like a major moment when queers really started to seriously think about having a strong criticism from a queer perspective, from a queer analysis of Israeli apartheid and Israeli occupation. And Israel, more than anything, is trying to make itself appear to be innocent as a liberal state, as a democracy, when in fact, like, it, you know, as this is a way that it uses to mask itself as apartheid, to mask the violence that it enacts on a daily basis on the Palestinian people who don't have citizenship status, or even the ones who do have citizenship status but have like a kind of second class status.
That was Natalie Curry-Toe of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid in Toronto. Next, we will hear from Leila Portavaf, who is a member of Q-Team, a radical queer collective in Montreal. Here she explains why Q-Team chose to organize a similar contingent under the banner Queers Come Out Against Israeli Apartheid in Sunday's Pride Parade in Montreal. She also responds to some of the criticisms of queer solidarity with Palestinians.
Q-Team, our kind of mission or mandate is to kind of have a politicized queer presence in Montreal, and a lot of the people who are in the group are queer but also work on a broad range of other issues, and so a lot of the work that we end up doing in Q-Team is doing solidarity work with different organizing and different activist issues that are happening in the city. And this particular issue, we felt, this is happening in the context of Perversité, which is 2 weeks of events, and we decided that for the Pride contingent, which we do every year we do some kind of intervention in the Pride parade to make sure that there's still a politicized presence in the parade. So this year we decided that this was the issue that we should mobilize around, partially because we've been working on the issue as Q-Team for over a year now, probably a couple of years, and partially because post-Gaza there was such a great sort of global movement of doing solidarity around Palestine at a sort of newer level, a expanded level, and we wanted to kind of contribute to that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to take a criticism coming from the other side, the opposing side, that often pro-Israel advocates will say, well, Israel is the only safe place in the Middle East for queer people, and therefore, you know, how can you bring this argument against Israel? How has Q-Team and other similar groups responded to this?
I mean, it's, I think, a twofold response. The first one is, I think homophobia exists everywhere, including in Canada, including in Israel, and you know, we just saw a brutal murder happen in Israel at the youth center or the youth meeting, which I really find it, like, I don't want to use that as an example of why Israel is homophobic, because I don't think that is an Israeli situation. That's just homophobia being manifested, and it happens everywhere. It's just an example of, like, brutal forms of homophobia that happen everywhere. And it happens in Canada, it happens in the U.S., it happens in Palestine, it happens, and it takes different forms based on cultural situations, whatever. But so on the one hand, I'm reluctant to say anywhere is really a safe haven for all queers. That I don't think exists still. So that's one thing. And then on the second hand, like, I think you can, for sure there are truths to saying that, you know, certain Muslim communities are more conservative around issues of sexuality. And I think as people who are members of those communities, myself included, we fight within those communities, within our own communities, to like have sort of queer rights be something that are accepted. I think just because certain communities may or may not be more homophobic than others, that doesn't justify the way that Israel has sort of taken the policies that it has towards Palestinians. So, I mean, I have a really hard time at all buying that Israel is a democratic state. I think there's multiple reasons to look at Israel as completely undemocratic and completely an apartheid state. But also, even if Israel was the most liberal democracy, that would still not justify the way that they treat Palestinians, whether or not there's absolutely no homophobia or plenty of sexism and homophobia. I don't think those two things are related.
So looking beyond Sunday, what are some of your hopes for what this contingent might concretely bring to Palestine solidarity organizing or just social justice and international solidarity organizing in general in Montreal?
I think it's what it's already done and what this is a part of is just like an exciting situation where you see people coming from really different places and coming together on different issues. And I don't think that this is particular to the Palestine issue. I really think it's true of range of issues that people in Montreal are organizing around. So again, I'm just reluctant to exceptionalize this particular issue because I think that happens too much. I think what's exciting about queers marching against Israeli apartheid is the fact that you see people tangibly make links between different forms of oppression. And even the queer groups that haven't endorsed it, like we've heard a lot of feedback saying that they've had really, you know, intense discussions about the issues and like whether or not certain queer groups feel that they should take on political positions or not is something that queer groups are debating. LGBT groups, like sort of more mainstream LGBT groups, there's like internal debate happening on that issue, and I think that's super important. I think that's an exciting thing that's happening, and I hope that that continues.
Again, that was Leila Portavaf of Q Team in Montreal, speaking on the importance of queer solidarity for Palestine. To put the issue into some historical perspective, we spoke with Tim McCaskill, a longtime queer activist living in Toronto. Over the last couple decades, Tim has been involved in a range of anti-racist and anti-imperialist organizing efforts, notably as one of the founders of the Simon Nicolai Anti-Apartheid Committee, a queer group which came together in Toronto in the 1980s to fight against South African apartheid. Today, Tim is also a member of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, and here he speaks about the Simon Nicolai Committee and why they brought the banner to the Pride Parade in Toronto this year.
We formed in 1986, if I remember correctly. Simon was a ANC, African National Congress, and UDF, which is United Democratic Front, activist in the townships in the early 80s. But he was also a gay man, although he had kept his work in the gay rights movement very separate from his work with the ANC. But he and a number of other activists were swept up in raids in 1985 and arrested and charged with treason because they'd been organizing rent strikes and demonstrations against rent hikes in the townships. And while he was in prison, he decided that he needed to come out as a gay man as well. I used to do the international news for a Canadian lesbian and gay newspaper called The Body Politic in those days, and I came across his case in a report from a Scottish gay paper and felt that queer people here in Canada had some responsibility to help defend Simon. And so we formed this group to give him support, but also to do anti-homophobia work in the anti-apartheid movement as it existed in Canada at the time, and anti-apartheid work in the gay communities here in Toronto.
What do you see are some of the parallels between the work that you were doing with that committee back in the 80s and the work that's happening today around Israeli apartheid with the group Queers Against Israeli Apartheid?
Well, the similarities are really quite startling. Now, South Africa was always a pretty homophobic place, so they never had the balls of Israel to claim their gay movement as a signal for their modernity. But South Africa did try to present itself as the only democracy, the only liberal country, the only democratic country in Southern Africa, and therefore excused its apartheid policies on that basis. So that's a really striking similarity, how this notion of we're a modern Western society just like you, and therefore we're under attack, and therefore we can do anything we need and anything we want. That was a line that the South African government pushed very strongly. Years later, people tend to forget the strength of support there was for South African apartheid. There were lots of people in the newspapers. The Canadian government wouldn't support divestment or sanctions or any of those kinds of things. They were talking about constructive engagement. So there was a real fight on the ground to get people to understand what apartheid was doing in Southern Africa. And that included a fight in the queer communities, because gay people were well aware that probably the only country that had a gay movement at that time was South Africa.
And for you, what was the significance of actually having the banner of the Simon Nicolle Anti-Apartheid Committee in the contingent at the Pride Parade this year?
Well, I think it showed a certain continuity of politics that's always been with us. We marched with that banner in Pride back in the mid-80s. And, I mean, there is a sense, sort of beyond the whole question of whether Pride's political or not, of politics in the queer community being focused on local queer issues and issues of queer rights, and forgetting the kinds of alliances and solidarities that have always been part of our movement. So it was heartwarming for me to be able to help demonstrate that there had always been this current in the gay community that said, we need to look beyond our own borders and we need to look beyond our own bodies and recognize that oppression against any group makes our struggle much more difficult, because there are queers everywhere, but if we're divided up on lines of racism or ethnicity or national rivalries, then we're a far weaker movement because of that.
There was recently a tragic killing of two gay youth in Tel Aviv on August the 1st, and Queers Against Israeli Apartheid put a short statement on the website. Just quickly, what are some of your reflections on this event?
Well, I mean, it was a terrible tragedy, and I think it shows how homophobia is alive and well all over the world. And people often, in the solidarity movement, I think that there's a danger. There's groups that sort of bring in queer refugees from different parts of the world, for example. And there's this notion that we in the West, or in the Western world, have sort of solved the problem of homophobia, and it's a problem of those people out there, which turns out to be kind of racist and othering. I grew up in a very small town in northern Ontario, and, you know, I don't need to go to the third world to look for examples of really brutal homophobia. And I think that these killings in Israel show that despite Israel's claims for tolerance, homophobia is alive and well there, just as it is in the occupied territories, just as it is in Canada or other parts of the world. And if we're engaged in solidarity work to try to struggle against the kinds of injustices that divide up our community, we need to be aware that homophobia isn't simply a one-sided issue. We're not some sort of missionaries from the developed world that are going to bring enlightenment to other parts of the world. It sort of gives a lie to the notion that if you're in the West, somehow you're tolerant and advanced on these issues.
Finally, we go to Haifa in Israel to hear the voice of Rauda Morkos, the general coordinator of Aswat, a Palestinian lesbian group, in an interview recorded last year.
Before talking about specifically the discrimination for Palestinian lesbians or for Palestinians in general, I would want to raise the challenges that we as Palestinian group might face or face in the day-to-day life. I think before that, I would say, like, the first challenge that any Palestinian face, or any Arab inside Israel or Palestine faces day to day in the day to day life is the occupation, in the various way it is represented. Now, if I focus on the Palestinian issue inside Israel, I would definitely focus on the fact that we don't have an own country, our own representation. The loss of land for me means the loss of who I am as a lesbian. This feeling of loss, I could connect to it as a lesbian when I am not allowed to live who I am. I'm not allowed to have my own country, and I'm not allowed to have my own identity. So I think the Nakba has also a different impact on us as lesbians.
You've been listening to Out Against Israeli Apartheid, a report produced by CKUT's Aaron Lakoff in Montreal. For more information on the growing movement of queer solidarity for Palestine, visit www.queersagainstapartheid.org.